Welcome. This is the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast with host Rob Giannino, where we have great conversation with really awesome experts from within the fly fishing community. You see, the fly fishing lifestyle is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us. Check out flyfishingjourneys.com for more podcasts, and please subscribe on your favorite podcast player. Here's your host, Rob Giannino.
Okay, thank you, Josh. And before we jump into the podcast, I wanted to give you guys a couple announcements that we are pretty excited about. Number one, we're coming up to the Lancaster Fly Fishing Show. This show is actually bittersweet because it's the last show of our fly fishing show season. It's always great to get together with all our friends in Lancaster, but it's also sad because for many of our friends, we won't see them again till the following show season. But the good news is great weather and the heart of the fishing season is right around the corner. If you're in the Pennsylvania or Tri-State area, please be sure to come out to the show. It's March 7th and 8th at the Lancaster County Convention Center in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Stop by the podcast booth. We'd love to say hello. Next, we want to tell you about a lot of great things coming down the pike for the Fly Fishing Journeys community. Number one, we do have a Facebook group, and that group is really growing. We'd love to have you as part of the community. Just look up Fly Fishing Journeys on Facebook and add yourself to the group. Number two, we're in final productions of a Fly Fishing Journeys app, which you'll be able to find on the iTunes App Store and Google Play Store. We also have a social community on our website, flyfishingjourneys.com. We're excited about the app because it'll be a much cleaner way to access the community on your phone. The app will also have notifications for all the new podcasts, blogs, and like I say, direct access to the social community group. Finally, keep your eye out on our Instagram at Fly Fishing Journeys for a sticker haul promotion we're doing with some great friends, Trout and Feather, Watermaster, Semperfly Fly Tying Products, and Douglas Rods. It's going to be a great sticker haul promotion that will kick off on St. Paddy's Day. Before I get to the podcast, I do want to thank our sponsors. Additionally, I want to thank you, our listeners. The reason is I've received some amazing feedback over the last several months of just how much you, our listeners, are supporting our sponsors, especially our show season signature sponsors, our favorite Rotary Vice Norvice, and our partners in insurance, Bissell Insurance Agency. Guys, I can't thank you enough. These are great partners and great sponsors. And without them, the podcast would not be possible. So thank you. You guys know how much I love my rotary vise. If you guys want more information on the vise that spins, check out nord-vise.com. If you're a guide, a fly shop, or anyone in the fly fishing industry, and you want to save money on your insurance program, please give our friends Bissell a shout at BisselInsuranceAgency.com. On this episode of the Fly Fishing Journeys podcast, we're going to talk to Tom Gilmore. Tom is the author of several books, including False Albacore, Tuna on the Fly, The Fly Fisher's Guide to New Jersey, The Fly Fisher's Guide to the Big Apple, and The Fly Fisher's Guide to Pennsylvania. We have a fun conversation, so let's kick it to the pod.
I'm more than excited to have Tom Gilmore on the podcast with us today. Tom caught his first fish on the fly in 1971. He's an author and a speaker, and to date he's written 5 books on fly fishing, including The Fly Fisher's Guide to Pennsylvania. Tom, thanks for being on our podcast.
My pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me.
I'm excited to have our conversation today because you have all this great knowledge about all these waters in New York and Pennsylvania. So we're going to take our listeners through a bunch of them.
Great.
Before we do, you were also the vice president and general manager of the Philadelphia Zoo. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, for 5 years. And then also part of the New Jersey Audubon Society.
I was the executive director of New Jersey Audubon Society, which is the largest tri-state conservation organization. And I did that for 30 years.
And you know Ted Williams?
Yes.
Yeah, we had
I know both of them.
Yeah, you actually know the
well,
baseball players.
I knew of the one.
Okay.
I knew one and knew of one, right.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because we had a podcast with Ted Williams, the conservation writer.
Yes.
Up in Marlboro. What a great guy. Yeah. He was also part of the Audubon Society.
He was part of National Audubon, and I think he may have been on their staff for a while. My state, New Jersey, was independent and actually predated the National Audubon Society.
Okay.
We were one of the co-founders. All the states got together and founded National to sort of be an umbrella organization.
Why don't you give our listeners a little bit of information about the Audubon Society?
Okay, well, the Audubon Society, I'll give you a little bit about the national and then our state. Both groups were founded in the 1800s, largely by women who were protesting the use of plumes from rare birds, egrets and herrings, that were being used in their hats and in their costumes. And so it's actually the women that started the movement. It became known as the Audubon Society, but really it's a conservation education, wildlife preservation group, not just birding, but we do have, particularly in New Jersey, some of the best birding and birders in the world. New Jersey Audubon hosts the World Series of Birding, which has close to 100 teams from around the world come and do a birding, 24-hour birding in the state of New Jersey.
Before we jump into all the fly fishing, we get some great stuff to talk about. Why don't you give our listeners just a brief understanding of what it's like to run a zoo?
Well, running the zoo, I was in charge of everything but the animals. It's like running a business, quite frankly. I mean, everything's a nonprofit and a lot of fun, but we brought in maybe 1,300,000 people a year. We provided gift shops for them and food service for them. One of the greatest zoos in the world is the Philadelphia Zoo. It was America's first zoo. Taking care of the animals and providing a healthy atmosphere for the animals. In some cases, we were breeding for a future release into the wild of some of the rare animals, but very popular for school children. And it's sort of their first exploration into the outdoors. It's not the wild outdoors, but it brings it a little closer to home.
Is it me, or can like having a zoo be a little bit controversial with some people?
Having a zoo can definitely be controversial. I mean, you're taking animals. A lot of people think you're taking them out of the wild. For the most part, that doesn't happen anymore. Years ago, it did. But for the most part, they're bred in captivity. They live longer in captivity. But there certainly is an argument that they shouldn't be in captivity.
Do you hear about that as a general manager of a zoo?
Yes, certainly did. And a lot of the arguments were valid. And a lot of it was just our failure to explain what we were doing. You know, a lot of the animals that we had, in fact, most of the animals we had, were either injured or orphaned and weren't going to make it in the wild. So, we're not trying to reduce what's in the wild. We're trying to protect what's there, save what's there, and in some cases, reintroduce some of these rare species into the wild.
So, in 2001, you wrote this book, False Albacore.
Right.
And so False Albacore, I mean, that's an interesting book to write as a first book. Do you have a background in writing?
No, I don't have a background in writing. And my English teacher, God bless her heart, would roll over in her grave if she thought someone was publishing something that I wrote. She really would roll over. Gilmore? But I had no interest in writing. I thought I had no ability to write. But I was fishing for stripers and bluefish, and I hooked into what I didn't know at first, but it turned out to be a false albacore. And I had never hooked into a fish like that in my life. The speed and strength and stamina the fish had. So I decided that that's going to be a fish I'm going to target, and I'm going to find out everything there is to know about it. And there really wasn't much to know back in the late 90s. It's not a commercially viable fish, so there aren't a lot of scientific studies on them. There aren't migration studies. There aren't tagging studies. So I hooked up with a website in every state along the East Coast into the Gulf, and every Friday night for 5 years I would print out the fishing reports. What bait were they on? What flies worked? When did they arrive? When did they depart? And how big they were? And I really had a tremendous migration study and habitat study without hiring anybody to tag the fish. There's only been, to my knowledge, one tag recaptured fish, false albacore.
Interesting.
In the Northeast. So I found out a tremendous amount of information. Found out that a lot of information was just guesswork prior to that. And I think with working with all the different states, I think we hammered out some real specifics that are factual about this fish. And during that time, I ran into guides that not only guided for false albacore, which was very rare back then, but people that guided for blackfin, bluefin, and yellowfin. And that's why I started working on that book. But I have to tell you, the name false albacore, the biologists call it little tuny, T-U-N-N-Y. And no fly fisherman wants to fish for a little anything.
Right.
So we renamed them false albacore.
Who's we?
The fly fishing community. But my wife at the time, I was on a deadline and I missed a couple picnics, or the family picnics, not my family, but her family. They said, well, where's Tom? I said, well, he's working on a deadline for a book. And they said, well, what's the book on? They just said false albacore. Well, of course, they'd never heard of false albacore. So I was like, well, are the real albacore? Well, yeah, there actually are. They're white meat tuna. And she said, yeah, but they don't take a fly and they're too deep to reach with a fly rod. It's like, wait a minute. Tuna eat flies? Well, some of them do. And she said, they didn't get it. Well, why does he eat them? oh no, they're not edible. They're all bloody. It's like, well, why does he fish them? Well, he enjoys it. Well, who's going to buy the book? My publisher's still asking me that question.
That's funny. What is the migratory pattern of the false albacore?
Well, in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic, they come up usually late August, depending on the water temperature. They're a pelagic species, like all the tuna, so they're out in the Gulf Stream a lot. And the Gulf Stream, if there's not enough food supply, they'll break off the Gulf Stream and come inshore, usually when the water warms, and particularly right around the first cold spell we get in the fall, in September, when all the bait fish start to migration south. And they'll come out of these estuaries and bays and inlets, which makes those narrow points like Montauk Point or some of the inlets congest the bait and then the people and the fish. They're all right there. Yep. In the south, we get them in Florida. Starting usually in April, it depends on the bait migration, and prime time in like around Miami and north is usually around all the month of June and July. And then my theory is when the water gets warm over 90 degrees, it starts getting too warm for them and they start migrating north. So we have a group that migrates from north to south, and then a group that's migrating from south to north, and they follow the Gulf Stream. And where I catch most of my fish is out off of West Miami Beach and Jupiter. And the Gulf Stream is only about 3 miles from shore. And then the next closest place is the Outer Banks, where it's maybe 15 or 20. And so they're running up and down the Gulf Stream. And they sort of crash with the northern group. Right around Harker's Island is famous for them. Harker's Island, North Carolina. And the people down there will call the small fish the Yankee fish.
Oh, boy.
And they call the big fish their fish.
That's funny. What's a good bait pattern?
They're predominantly chasing small baits, little mullet in the fall, bay anchovy, which is a very tiny fish, maybe 1.5 to 3 inches, 4 inches. Silversides, Atlantic silversides is a great fish for them. Small butterfish, but the albies have very small mouths and little in the way of teeth. They're just little tiny specks. They're really not much in the way of teeth, so they have to swallow their bait whole. Whereas a bonita, which is a very similar fish, has the teeth like a bluefish, and it can cut the bait in half.
So it's not the same fish?
Not the same fish.
A lot of people refer to the false albacore and bonito as the other.
As the same fish. In Florida, they're all bonita, but they're not. They're false albacore.
False albacore.
Yeah. In fact, I've never caught a bonita in Florida, and I've caught hundreds of false albacore in Florida. But the main difference is, in their looks, the bonita have both vertical and horizontal stripes. They run smaller, and the bonita have teeth. They're very sharp teeth, and fortunately, there's space, so if you hook one on a fly, your leader usually fits between them, and they don't bite them off. Because I would say, of the two species, by far the bonita is the most has the best eyesight, and is the most selective, and is most leader shy.
And the Northeast has the false albacore?
And the bonita.
But they're both there.
Yes, they're both there. The false albacore come in first. They need a little bit warmer water than the bonita, but they will come in first late August, and so farther north, maybe early August, and then the bonita will follow them by maybe a week or two.
And they look similar.
Well, they look similar, but there's much more coloring in the bonita, which in Spanish means beautiful. They have both horizontal, as I mentioned, vertical stripes. The albie doesn't have any stripes. It's got five what I call fingerprints up by their throat, but really they're very close.
Okay. And so now you're knee-deep in all this knowledge about the false albacore, and then you started learning that you could catch tuna on the fly.
Yes.
So tell me about your adventures of tuna on the fly, because then you've come up with this book, Tuna on the Fly.
Right. It took a while to get to do the research, as I'd call it, for my wife.
Yes. And I'm familiar with that terminology.
But a lot of the guides, particularly, were getting blackfin down in the Keys and in Florida. And up in New England, we had a comeback of schoolie bluefins coming inshore. And so the thought of catching any bigger tuna on the fly intrigued me. And then once I got two of the three main species that are fly rodable between blackfin, yellowfin, and bluefin, I decided to do a book on it. And I was halfway through the book, and I'd never hooked a bluefin or a yellowfin.
You were very confident one was coming, though.
And they did come. But the yellowfin came very late. The bluefin was much more cooperative. The bluefin we were finding inshore a lot closer. In fact, we even caught them in Cape Cod Bay. Whereas the yellowfin are a deeper water fish.
Yeah, more pelagic.
Fish. Yeah, and I had four week-long trips in a row canceled. The best one was canceled when I was on the way down. The other three got canceled while I was sitting in a motel room for 5 nights.
Weather.
Because you're going out maybe 100 miles to catch these fish.
We go out of Niantic, Connecticut on my buddy's 38-foot Bertrand. and we go for the bluefin out to the canyons.
Okay.
We'll run out 100 miles. Yep. We'll fish for 3 days. You just kind of rotate sleeping. Nobody really sleeps.
Right.
You take a quick nap, and then you just fish all night.
Yep. Well, the yellowfin was the one, and I had, as I said, 4 trips got blown out. The fifth trip, I couldn't get anybody to go with me. I mean, they're like,
Let me give you my number.
You're cursed.
Oh, right, because nobody wanted to go with the weather.
So we go, and it's, I mean, we went hurricane, everything. And we go, and we're going to go down in July. They said there's never been a named tropical storm or hurricane hit North America in the months of July or August. Katrina hit in August that year.
Oh, boy.
But prior to that, I called up, and there was a hurricane and a tropical storm coming into Venice, Louisiana. And the tropical storm, I'm not sure the name of it. It may have been Cindy. And I called my guy, and I said, is this going to hurt us? And he says, no, that'll be out of here by the time you get down. But there's a hurricane called Dennis, and it's over Cuba, and it's coming in like a son of a gun. So can you get down here a day early? So I had to convince my friends to go a day early from work and tell their wives, or not tell their wives, where they were going, and watch as we drove to Venice, Louisiana, which is about 3 hours south of New Orleans, while all the cars were heading north for emergency exit.
And you're going the wrong way.
We're going the wrong way.
What the heck?
And he guaranteed that we'd be done. We moved our plane up a day, and we would be on our plane and out there before it hit. And as it was, we were going to go to Florida next, and we had to go north up into Tennessee, I guess it was, and then down along the coast to avoid the hurricane. And we got in Florida after it hit and fished for albies for 3 days. But we get to the marina. This is the fifth year now I've tried. Beautiful day, balmy day, bluebird day. Everything's perfect. And the guide says, they're out there. I was talking to he would give beer to the fellows on the oil rigs. And so he was good friends with them. He'd bring out newspaper cigars and he says, there's fish everywhere. We go out to such and such a rig, fish everywhere. We're golden. So, okay, we're really excited now. All of a sudden, there's a loud explosion in the marina. The power blew. There was no wind. And my friends just said, like, you're cursed. And I said, no, you know, they got to have a backup generator. I mean, you got ice, you got beer, you need power to pump gasoline. No sweat, guys. They got backup generators.
Nothing.
We sat in an unair-conditioned bar at the marina drinking warm beer, praying the power would come on. And guide came in and he goes, 40 minutes and then I'm canceling. All of a sudden the power came on.
Oh, boy.
Out of nowhere. He pumped the thing up and out we go. And we go out. Oh, I guess we were probably 3,000 feet of water. And as we're approaching the oil rig, just in the distance, the sun setting, all you could see behind the setting sun was all these fish jumping. And it was yellowfin, blackfin, and false albacore jumping like crazy.
Wow.
But mostly blackfin. And first, four of us got up to fish, and we made four casts, and three of us landed blackfin on those first four casts.
What's the size of a blackfin?
Blackfin there.
Because I'm not familiar with the black. I'm familiar with the blue and the yellow.
The blackfin, the world record on a fly is low 30s, 32, 35 pounds. Most of the blackfin you're going to catch are in the low teens. On one trip there, we had several trips to Venice, Louisiana after that. One of my anglers caught four over 25, but none 30. But you got four between 25 and 30, which was a fly record just right around the corner from that. But he said to me on the phone when I called the guide, he said, you're going to have to cull through acres of blackfin to get that yellowfin you want.
And that was true?
Cull through acres. I mean, my God. Yeah, that was very true. At 3 in the morning, we had one yellowfin in the boat, a friend of mine. We had one between the four of us. And at 3 in the morning, I'm still casting from dusk with a 16 weight. And we had started with 14s the year before. And at 3 o'clock in the morning, I landed my 27th blackfin. And my next cast was a yellowfin. It took an hour and 45 minutes to land.
Wow.
Went back into an oil rig.
What size, like 80?
It was gutted. It was 87 pounds gutted and bled. So I could have pushed 100.
Yeah.
And at that time, no one in North America had a 100-pound one, and I learned why. Hour and 45 minutes, it got back almost, we thought it was in the oil rig. The current was taking us to the oil rig, and the guy did a very incredible trick. He backed down to the oil rig, had me keep as tight as I could possibly do, and we get to the oil rig, and he goes to the side of it and behind slightly, and he says, now pull hard once, and ease off. So I pulled hard, and I'm pulling back towards the rig. and the fish takes off away from the rig and the pressure, and you just leave it, and we let it run for probably a half a mile.
Just to get away from the rig.
Get away from the rig, and then a couple more battles, and all of a sudden it's flying across the top, and he's screaming, "You lost it." And I'm like, "No, it's coming back at me." Line's all slack. Here's about 12-foot hammerhead, the biggest shark I've ever seen, chasing it.
Oh, boy, he was trying to get away.
Right on its tail, and they got the lights in the boat. And the mate, he opened up the cooler and got out a blackfin and threw it to the hammerhead.
Get it rid of it.
Hammerhead took, grabbed the blackfin. He did it twice. And then he took the butt end, the rubber part of the gaff. He hit it over the head, and we never saw the shark again. It was the biggest shark I'd ever seen. And then when we sort of got used, hour and 45 minutes, I did not want my only yellowfin eaten by
it. Right.
There was the yellowfin just wobbling on top. It was done.
Exhausted.
Just backed down on it and brought it in.
Obviously, you caught the yellowfin on top, right? Because they were rolling, so
yes.
You could catch it with the fly. But a bluefin.
We've had bluefin. Every trip that I've caught bluefin on, they've been busting on top.
You didn't have to tease it up?
Nope.
Mm-mm.
Cape Cod Bay and just off of Cape Cod is where we usually went for them. Although we've got them off of Jersey where they were chasing bait on top.
Interesting. Well, I know they do that, but I mean, to be at the right place at the right time is difficult.
And rare. Yes, it is difficult and rare. Some of the guides that I fish with will live chum, and that makes all the difference in the world. If they're not coming on top themselves naturally, if they get some live chum out there, then
start coming up.
Bring them up, yeah.
Well, that's interesting. So you've got the two books out now. You got the Albie on the Fly, the Tuna on the Fly. And now you're into this world of the Fly Fisher's Guides. Talk about the Fly Fisher's Guides as a whole, because you have three of them.
Right. My publisher for those guides is Wilderness Adventures Press. And they have done a guidebook for virtually every state. I mean, they may have missed two or three states for trout, where they give the directions and the hatches and the best locations to fish. It's a tremendous series. I probably have 13 of the guides, and it's helped me in Alaska all the way to Florida
with
guides. I was pleased when they contacted me to do Fly Fisher's Guide to New Jersey. But I was living in New Jersey at the time. There are 9 Trout Unlimiteds in New Jersey, and they all go to the Catskills. They go to western New Jersey, great trout fishing in our mountains there. But they'll go to the Catskills or the Poconos or the Lehigh Valley Limestone. So I said, well, you know, the guys in New Jersey don't just fish New Jersey. We're so close to these other areas. Let me do a regional guide and do 150 miles in New York City. And that gets in the tailwater of the Upper Delaware. It gets in some of our limestoners and the Catskills and the Poconos. So they agreed to do that, and that was our first venture together with Wilderness Adventure Press.
And so this is the Fly Fisher's Guide to the Big Apple.
The Big Apple.
Well, this is a fun one. Now, this one here, it's thicker. It's a little kind of smaller in length,
right.
And it's more black and white. A lot of great charts and great information, but black and white.
Right.
How do you decide whether you can do black and white or like your new one here, the Fly Fisher's Guide to Pennsylvania, which is a bigger, taller book and more the glossy, full color? How does that work?
Right. My publisher, Wilderness Adventure, he had at the time done over 150 titles, all 6x9 and all black and white. And I came up with this book, and I really loved working with them. They did a great job on it. A good friend of mine is an outdoor writer from Virginia, and he had two books that he published that were 8.5x11 full color. And I'd walk into a fly shop, and I'd see his full-color book looking at me. And over in the dusty corner would be my little black and white all alone. So I said to my publisher, he had asked me to do a tailwater book, an eastern tailwater book. And I said, I will do it if you'll do it 8.5x11 full-color. He said, well, Tom, that really racks up, you know, the cost.
Yeah.
I said, I know, but boy, they sell like crazy, but, you know. So I sent him my friend's book to look at, and he was impressed with it. He came up with a number. He said, well, if you'll buy X amount, then we'll publish X amount, and we'll do it. So I had to talk my wife into it. I said, you know that wall in the living room that's really no decoration here? How would you like to have about $5,000 worth of cartons in there with a book in it that I wrote? So she bit the bullet, and we gambled, and I do a lot of shows and a lot of TUs, and we moved to all the books. And he was so I was pleased. I was thrilled with the job they did on it. And he was so pleased that they have not done a black and white 6x9 since. Every book they've done since the Big Apple has been in this format, 8.5x11 full color.
So your intuition was correct.
Yes.
That's awesome. And the first one you did was the Fly Fisher's in the full color after doing the Big Apple in the 6x9.
Right.
You did the Fly Fisher's Guide to Eastern Trophy Tailwaters.
Yes.
So what were you telling me yesterday, Tom, about the trophies and whatnot in the tailwaters?
What's interesting is that in most of our state records, we usually see that they come from lakes. Lakes have a lot of larger body of water, higher biomass. But in reality, it's mostly just the rainbows, the state records that are coming out. When you get into the brown trout and the brook trout, particularly the browns, the tailwaters are producing bigger fish. I mean, I'm talking about fish state records 18 to 29 pounds along the East Coast.
A lot of people obviously know, most people know what a tailwater is, but maybe for some of our listeners who don't know what a tailwater is, why don't you help them with that?
Yeah, a tailwater is kind of the newest venture in our trout fishing system. And how I define it is it's a reservoir or lake that releases the water either from the bottom of the reservoir lake or from the middle down, not a top water release. Top water release, you're going to have much warmer water than you will in the stream because it's been baking.
Yep.
But you get that bottom release, it does a couple of things for this trout stream below it. And in fact, if it's not a trout stream, sometimes it creates it. You're getting cold water coming through. Water temperature varies very little from month to month. Most of these tailwaters you can fish year-round because they're not freezing and they're not too hot in the summer. The other thing that is really unique about them is virtually no flooding because you're not getting fed by a watershed. You're getting fed by a lake. They can control the outflow. They're also less subject to drought. And what that does for the insects, if you have a trout stream that is very shallow in the summer and its rocks are exposed to the sun, the bugs that were under those rocks when it was underwater are now dying because there's no water, there's no heat. Likewise, if you get flooding, those insects are getting washed downstream. So a tailwater is much more conducive to having a large biomass of aquatic life to feed the trout.
Yeah, unless the damn electric company doesn't want to cooperate with you.
For the most part, they do. There's three types of tailwaters, and you should know which ones you're fishing. Flood control, water supply, and power generation. Flood is, if they're predicting a big rain event, they're going to let a little more water out than normal. Water supply is pretty standard. So those two tailwaters don't have large fluctuations. Power generation, when you put the plug on in your house, they're pulling it on the generating plant, and they're producing water. And they produce tremendous volumes. Most of the streams I'm fishing, the flow from when they turn on the generators goes up maybe 3 or 4 feet.
Yeah.
There's one tailwater, the Chattahoochee, down in Georgia, 12 feet.
Yeah.
They don't even float that when they're releasing the water.
Yeah, that's dangerous.
Now, the crazy thing about this is, for safety's sake, the power companies are required by federal law to post when they're going to release.
The release times, yeah.
They're not required to follow them.
Oh, okay. Well, that's a big difference.
So you want to find out when the release times are. Know that they're not always accurate. Talk to the local tackle shop. See if they've been on, and then talk to them about what you can do in a tailwater. What I'll do is I'll fish up by the release if it's going to happen while I'm there. Up by the release until it happens.
Yep.
And then I'll go downstream, get ahead of it. And the tackle shop can say, well, down here it takes 5 hours for the release to get to. And so you can fish down here for 5 hours after the release. So we catch fish, release, go downstream, fish. Water starts coming down there. If you still want to fish some more, you can go back up to the release. It's been over for a while.
Yeah.
And fish it there.
Up at the Deerfield, and I know that's here in your book. I just checked. And, you know, we do have one of those electric monitored or electric released dams.
Right.
And it's bottom release, and it would be an amazing trout fishery, and it really is an amazing trout fishery, but the trout have a hard time because they don't really keep to their schedule, and sometimes they let it run dry. I mean, I was looking at it, some pictures online, because a lot of the TU was very frustrated by it, that it was almost dry this December. I mean, you could see
the Deerfield?
The major holes.
Wow.
That are full of water, that you could see the rocks in the bottom.
Now, was that up by, do you know if it was up by Fife?
It is below, the Fife Brook Dam.
Because that's interesting, because I got an email from a guide who I interviewed for the book there, and in February, maybe 3rd or 4th, he said, Tom, I already have 5 fish over 5 pounds. You got to get up here. The biggest one was 10. So I don't know. I don't know what happened.
This was December.
Yeah. But no, that's a problem, but that stream gets some very, very big fish.
Yeah, it's a great river.
It really is. Dry fly river.
Yeah, I wish they would be a little bit more consistent with their releases as far as letting us know what's actually going to happen. And I wish the fishing was more of a reason why they manage the river. It isn't for the fishing, it's the power.
It's not.
I think the rafters even come before the fishermen.
They come, I don't know the the rafters on the Deerfield as well as I know them on the Lehigh. I live near the Lehigh. And there's probably 1,000 rafters for every fly fisherman on that river. Mm. And the Francis E. Walter Dam, when they built the dam, they put the road on the inside of the dam, mm-hmm. down 20 feet from the surface, so they could never fill it.
Right.
So finally they put the road 30 years later on top. They can fill it. They can get more water than they've been having. But clearly the rafters get first priority for economic reasons on that river, on the releases. But it's still a great, the Lehigh's still a great fishery. And if they can ever get it managed, both for the rafters and for the fish, it'd be even better. I've caught wild trout on 9 of the Lehigh River tributaries, so it's a great region.
Mm-hmm. And so in the Eastern Trophy tailwaters, you have Maine, New Hampshire, Mass, Connecticut, New York, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, Tennessee, and North Carolina, and Georgia. So you're covering the entire Atlantic seaboard,
yes,
for the trophy tailwaters.
Right, and there's a trophy tailwater within two hours of every East Coast fisherman, except for Florida fishermen.
That's incredible. Well, we'll have our listeners check out Eastern Trophy Tailwaters, Fly Fisher's Guide. That's a really cool book. And then the last one we'll talk about here is Pennsylvania. So this is the Fly Fisher's Guide to Pennsylvania by Tom Gilmore. Over 160 waters that you, yeah, cover in this book. Incredible maps and charts and locations and, you know, how-tos, where-tos. It's one of those guides that you kind of dog ear and,
yep,
highlight and write in and write on and have a great time with it. So tell me about this book, Tom.
When I got out of the saltwater books, and I wrote on two species that have not been written about before in saltwater. There's no other books on false albacore, and I don't think any on tuna, certainly not many. I never thought I'd get into the trout fishing book, and I went to find a trout stream that I had fished many years ago and couldn't find access. And I had a book that said, take side roads off of such and such a route. Well, there were 19 side roads, and the first 18 I went to were, when I got to the end, were posted. And so it was 5 miles down and back 18 times, 4.5 hours, and I didn't fish that day. So I said, that's why people don't try new streams. So I'm going to, when I started the Big Apple, getting people out to other waters easily. Here's the map. Here are the written directions. Here's the time to go. Here are the hatches. The Pennsylvania book hadn't been rewritten in about 25 or 30 years. And then this year, there are actually two Pennsylvania books. But Pennsylvania has more trout streams than any, more miles of trout stream than any stream, any state other than Alaska. The number of wild trout streams we have, the amount of trout production waters, and the amount of stocking is just staggering. And we have great tailwaters, we have great limestone spring creeks, some of the best in the world, and great freestone streams. So it really is a great state to trout fish in.
Very diverse.
Very diverse.
And I had Tom Baltz on earlier today, and we had a nice conversation about the chalk streams and the Latort and Big Springs. And so,
right,
I noticed they're all in your books.
Yep.
We were actually using your book,
okay,
during the
good
podcast to,
great,
kind of fine-tune in my knowledge, because, right, I'm not a very experienced fly fisherman here in Pennsylvania. You know, you hear all these words and these terms,
right,
like Big Springs, and obviously I knew the Latort. You know, Yellow Breeches I wasn't super familiar, mm-hmm, with. So it's good to kind of dive into a book like,
right,
this and get that understanding even before talking to somebody like Tom, who has just an incredible heritage in that area. So it's been great having you on.
It's been great to be here. I really,
yeah,
enjoyed it.
What would you say would be like one or two spots? We don't necessarily want hot spots, but maybe just more popular places that people know about. But if you were to pull out a couple spots that people might want to check out in the from the Pennsylvania book.
Okay. Let's start in the Pocono Mountains. The Big Bushkill, 6 miles of fly fishing only on a scout reservation. Very wilderness experience, but very easy to get into. The Broadhead, which is actually where fly fishing in North America started. The Catskills has a reputation for that, but in truth, it was almost 50 years before the Catskill fly fishing started. It happened in the Poconos because the trains from Philadelphia got to the Poconos before the trains from New York got to the Catskills. And the Broadhead has served several presidents and is an excellent stream.
The Poconos.
Yep.
That might be a good destination trip for somebody.
The Poconos would be a great destination. There are Class A streams there. It's well stocked. You got in the Stroudsburg area, you got the Broadhead, the Big Bushkill. McMichael's is a sleeper. Pocono Creek is a sleeper.
And I just learned in your book today that the brook trout is the state fish.
It's a state fish for many states. It's in the Northeast, it's the only native species.
Yeah.
All the others were introduced. Brown trout in Pennsylvania, probably late 1800s, and rainbows, early 1900s.
I think if you're in Pennsylvania, though, you have to say wild brown.
Oh, no, they're not native. They're wild.
They're wild. You
absolutely
have to say it, though.
Absolutely.
You have to say wild brown.
Or you don't go on an internet site and say native brown trout.
Or don't even just say brown trout.
No, yeah.
You don't go out in Pennsylvania, you don't go out and catch a brown trout. You go out and catch a wild brown trout.
Wild brown trout or stock brown trout. But not native.
Every one of my Pennsylvania friends refer to the brown trout as a wild brown trout.
Okay. And they've been reproducing in this country, in Pennsylvania for over 100 years, but they're still not native.
No.
And never will be.
No. Germany owns that, right?
Yep. But I have fly fished Pennsylvania for almost 50 years and kept accurate records of every trout I've caught. And my biggest brook trout in Pennsylvania, I've got 5-pounders in New England, but is 12 and a half inches. And the first time I gave a program on the Pennsylvania book, I said, the biggest brook trout I've ever caught in Pennsylvania on a freestone stream is a measured 12 and a half inch brook trout. And a gentleman raised his hand and he said, well, what's the difference between a measured 12 and a half inch brook trout and a regular 12 and a half inch brook trout? And I thought for a minute, I said, it's about 3 inches.
I was going to say that. It's about 3 inches.
It's the truth.
Yeah. Truth. That's funny. Yeah. So good. Maybe once you hit stop on this podcast, you can tell me where you caught a 5-pounder brook trout in New England.
Maybe I can.
Well, that's great. Well, Tom, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the podcast. You're a wealth of information. These books are really cool. Thank you for autographing Tyler's for him. Okay. And I know he's going to be putting that book to great use because we've been thinking, where can we go fly fishing around your university, Ty? The Fly Fisher's Guide to Pennsylvania is going to help him with that.
That's terrific. Well, thank you very much for having me. I enjoyed it very much.
It's been fun, and maybe we can do it again.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to Fly Fishing Journeys with your host, Rob Giannino. To be notified of new episodes, subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or Google Podcasts. You can follow us on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram. For past episodes, check out flyfishingjourneys.com. Fly fishing is a journey, and we're glad you're on this journey with us.